openers. They went on to mentor elementary school students after school, read to them, and help them with math. I never took attendance. I didn't know who was going except for the original social worker. But whenever we were back from sea duty, sailors could always be found at the school tutoring, coaching, and doing anything else they were asked to. And the idea of community service spread. Whenever we pulled into a foreign port, 40 or 50 sailors would go off and find an orphanage or hospital that could use a few helping hands. Benfold made us all proud in so many ways that it is hard to single out one achievement above the others. But for me, the one that stands out was the volunteer spirit we created throughout the ship. It was heartwarming to see these young people, almost all of them from underprivileged backgrounds, giving of themselves to make things better for others. And not because they had to, but because they wanted to. I know that government programs do a lot of good and help a lot of people, but only local communities really understand the nuances of their challenges. One-size-fits-all programs tend to fit none. I think business has to pick up some of the slack. It is good for morale, good for your reputation, and good for your soul. Companies are right there in the community, and they can target their efforts to where they're most needed. It really isn't complicated. The need is there, staring them in the face, and filling it benefits everyone, those who do as well as those who receive. I recently spoke to a group of managers at a nuclear power plant, which are often the subject of controversy and have to be recertified periodically, a process that includes public hearings. One of the considerations is the plant's track record as a member of the community. Before I was to speak, I talked to my mother, who was in her 90s, and after teaching English and typing for 41 years, was still called in as a substitute till age 86. The school district in Altoona, Pennsylvania, pays substitute teachers $55 a day. You do the math. Look at the value we are placing on education. Mom told me that she was teaching calculus, math, geometry, and chemistry, subjects in which she had no expertise. I learned later that other school districts were hiring high school graduates to be substitute teachers. What's wrong with this picture? Now, most of the people who run nuclear power plants have advanced degrees in physics and math and other tough subjects. It struck me that the plant should partner with the local school district so that when they need a substitute teacher, a plant employee could take a day off and pitch in. A company could easily set up a program to give people a day or two a year to volunteer as substitutes. It would be a win-win situation for everyone. Good for the school district and good for the company, and it would do wonders for the employees to get away from the routine of work, go back to school, and make a difference in children's lives. I can't think of a downside for anyone involved. The head of the power plant told me he was going to pursue the idea. I hope every manager who hears this will follow his lead. Go for the obvious. It's probably a winner. Sometimes a solution is so simple and so apparent that we ignore it. We think it isn't innovative or cool or complex enough, or that others have considered and discarded it. That's a big mistake. While Benfold, Gary, and Harry W. Hill were in the South China Sea en route to Singapore, we got word that a German naval task force was heading toward us on the way to Japan. The German Navy rarely strays from NATO waters, but this squadron was touring the Western Pacific. We were told to plan an encounter with the German Navy and see what kind of training we could work out. The task fell to the senior commanding officer on USS Gary, and I saw it as a huge opportunity. I was excited about it and came up with a plan to simulate the German ships as the enemy and conduct a battle at sea. Then we would exchange personnel to visit one another's ships, and we would do joint maneuvers in the South China Sea. The two other captains didn't care much about this, but I argued that we were at sea. There was nothing else to do, and we might as well have fun and get some training out of it. It turned out to be a great learning experience. We transferred people from ship to ship. We refueled from the Germans' oiler. We sent them over several cases of Miller Genuine Draft, Budweiser, and Rolling Rock. We learned a lot about working with our allies, and they learned a lot about us. It was a wonderful opportunity. Sometimes people are myopic. They get into a set pattern, and they can't envision the potential benefits they could glean from various situations. Our great training exercise with the German Navy in the South China Sea almost didn't happen because some didn't think it was important. Don't work harder, work smarter. Not long after we returned to San Diego in early 1998, Benfold entered a commercial shipyard for 9 weeks of maintenance, during which the equipment was dismantled and rebuilt to extend its life. All well and good, except that the process was a mess. A beautiful ship is torn apart and soon gets covered with dirt, oil, and grime. To most of the shipyard employees, it's just another construction site, loaded with cables, pipes, and steel plates. Making sure they don't break anything is a full-time monitoring task and no fun whatsoever. You're always dirty. You always wear a hard hat and earplugs because of the danger and noise, and the work is badly coordinated. One day, a painting crew will leave passageways fresh and sparkling. Next day, riggers will haul equipment through, leaving scratches in their wake, or electricians will rip up freshly sanded decks to get at wires underneath. You would think that shipyards would be full of smart project managers skilled at coordinating these jobs. But, in my experience, no one ever thought of automating the process. I spoke to my lieutenant, Jerry Olin, who had now become one of my go-to ninjas. "We can do this better," I said. "We can help the shipyard. We can show them how to dovetail all these jobs so that nothing ever has to be redone. And the whole project gets finished on schedule, if not sooner." It wasn't easy. But with the help of Petty Officer Derek Thomas and his experience with databases, Jerry created a computer tracking system to manage the 9-week overhaul process. We also sent half our crew to school for training that they could not get on the ship. So we were doing this with a vastly reduced workforce. We were trying to juggle a million balls in the air, and Jerry never dropped one. All in all, we were maximizing the return on taxpayer dollars. It soon became clear that we would finish the work in 7 weeks instead of 9, a feat that was unheard of. I immediately requested permission to move Benfold back to our pier at the naval station, where it was cleaner. The answer, you guessed it, was no. The logic, and I use the word loosely, was classic bureaucracy think. We contracted to keep you there for 9 weeks. You stay there 9 weeks. "But that's stupid," I said. Response? "We pay this shipyard $10,000 a day in rent, even if you're not there. It's in the contract. Do you really want us to throw away $10,000 a day?" I tried to argue that it made more sense to spend the $140,000 and get Benfold back to its berth and operational readiness, rather than let the ship and its crew go to pot for 2 weeks. I had a miserable fight over this, and used up a lot of political capital in the process. But finally, my betters retreated, and we left the shipyard 2 weeks ahead of schedule. Then the budget figures arrived. Our budget for the 9 weeks was $3 million, and we brought it in at about $2.2 million. Not only had we gotten the work done right the first time 2 weeks ahead of schedule, we had also cut the cost by some 25%, far more than we had supposedly wasted by leaving the yard early. When was the last time a Department of Defense project was finished flawlessly, under budget, and ahead of schedule? What's more, unlike other ships, we left the yard with Benfold absolutely spotless. Our computerized system had factored in cleanup and repainting. The president of the yard was dumbfounded. He just could not restrain himself from claiming that it was all due to his caring, meticulous civilian workers. That was nonsense, to say the least. But I wasn't going to argue the point. My boss knew how it happened. We didn't work any harder than anyone else. We worked smarter. I applied the same principle to attack an epidemic of mechanical failures that was sweeping all the Arleigh Burke-class destroyers in the Atlantic and Pacific fleets. These ships, including Benfold, have an enormous demand for electricity, which they get from gas turbine generators. The ship can run on two of them, with a third on board for emergencies. The generators operate like jet engines, at enormous speed. Their critical cooling mechanism is a heat exchanger that runs seawater through metal tubes in the lubricating oil reservoir. The generators cost upward of $1.5 million each. but some designer had decided to save money by using cheap metal for the reservoir tubes. The tubes cost about $7,000. The upshot was that the tubes corroded, the pipes cracked, seawater contaminated the oil, and the motors broke down. When Benfold lost two generators in a very short period of time and had to limp back to port, I started digging and found out that there had been around 60 similar failures. I wrote a message to the three-star admiral in San Diego blasting the design. It was then that he realized not only had this cost the Navy $60 million in lost generators, but that we could not replace them fast enough. So the Navy was losing combat capability. An obvious solution was to replace the tubes with a tougher alloy such as Monel. But something more might be needed. And the way the Navy worked, I knew it would take a year of studies before anything was approved. I needed a fix now because I was down to one generator. We took one of our broken lube oil coolers to a local engineering shop where we had Monel tubes installed. We tested it and it worked, so we fixed the other one. And those heat exchangers are working to this day. As I tell my people, when you see a bad trend developing, you need to yell and holler until people pay attention to it. My flagging the breakdowns let the admiral push the Navy to focus on the broader problem, but meanwhile, I was able to make my own fix by taking another kind of initiative. The point is, none of it happened by simply following standard procedure. Don't fight stupidity, use it. The Navy's rules insisted on restricting young sailors to their ships when they arrived in overseas ports. The admirals were sure that these lusty young people would get into trouble as soon as they stepped on dry land in a foreign country, to say nothing of what could happen if they were to have a beer. We went to great places, Australia, Japan, Singapore, Thailand, which of course the sailors wanted to see. After all, the recruiting posters had promised they would see the world. But according to the Navy, they weren't mature enough to resist whatever temptations might present themselves. The Navy expected these people to risk their lives in combat, but it was treating them as infants. I would be the last to claim that sailors on liberty always act in ways that make the Navy proud, but this rule was both stupid and insulting. The last straw came when a clever admiral in headquarters devised an insidious plan to minimize shore leave. His idea was linked to the Navy's Enlisted Surface Warfare Specialists, ESWS program, a superb system designed to train sailors beyond their specialties so they can learn how their entire ship works. With this training, they can backstop others. Everyone's skills are enhanced and the ship's performance as a whole is strengthened, particularly in a crisis. When USS Cole was bombed in Yemen in 2000, it might very well have sunk if all hands knew only their own areas of duty. Instead, enough people understood the overall rescue plan and how their areas of expertise affected it. This additional knowledge was critical in their efforts to save the ship. This is the equivalent of a salesperson understanding the working of finance, marketing, product development, human resources, the entire structure of the company. Sailors who complete ESWS wear a special pin on their uniforms and earn bonus points toward promotion. It is so difficult that only the most experienced sailors usually try to qualify. The admiral, intent on limiting shore leave, decided that no one under 21 could stay ashore in a foreign port after midnight unless he or she had qualified for ESWS. It might have been a noble policy if the idea had been to encourage people to get qualified. Instead, the wording of the directive left the clear impression that it was intended to deprive people of a right rather than enhance a process. Now, if I had blatantly disregarded the admiral's directive, I could have been fired. More important, my actions would have sent a message to my crew that it was all right to ignore policies you don't agree with. But if I could not change a stupid rule, I could use it for my own purposes. I could try to interest the crew in qualifying for the program, which would get them liberty and, more to the point, increase the readiness of our ship. However, since hardly anyone had passed ESWS in my predecessor's time, the crew was convinced that it was unattainable, so few even attempted it. In fact, Benfold's ESWS program was so hard, that I'm not sure I could have passed it myself. My goal was to change that perception. Because I was proud of Benfold, I often invited guests to join me in touring the ship. And it occurred to me that, in a sense, the ESWAS program basically taught sailors to be tour guides. In this context, a good tour guide would explain how the engines, generators, and weapon systems work, how we control aircraft, the mechanics of the anchors, and much more. ESWAS qualifiers understood and could describe how the ship's many parts interact to make it a fighting machine. I reviewed and streamlined the qualification process, removing about 15% of the requirements because they weren't relevant to Benfold. Then, I gathered all the sailors together and explained that ESWAS was a good way for them to learn how to show guests around the ship. Once we defined it in those terms, the sailors became confident. Hey, we can do this. Plus, it will help us get promoted. And somehow, word got out that an ESWAS pin would also entitle underage sailors to liberty. Nearly every sailor aboard joined the program. By the time we pulled into Bahrain on October 3rd, I was able to qualify my first junior sailor as an enlisted surface warfare specialist. He was Fireman Joseph Cotton, 20 years old, and deservedly proud of his achievement. We soon got word that General Anthony Zinni, the 4-star Marine, who was commanding the entire Middle East Force, wanted to tour our ship. I thought, what a fortunate coincidence. I assembled all my junior enlisted personnel on the flight deck for the general's arrival. Among them was Fireman Cotton, my designated star for the occasion. General Zinni came aboard with Vice Admiral Tom Fargo, the U.S. Ambassador to Bahrain, their security details, and a passel of aides. I asked the general if he would do Fireman Cotton the honor of pinning an ESWAS pin on him. He was happy to oblige. For generals and admirals, pinning awards on sailors is the equivalent of politicians kissing babies. "And now, sir," I said, "the ship is ready for your inspection." "Lead the way," the general said. "Another time, sir. Today, Fireman Cotton will give you the tour." "Say again?" "Fireman Cotton will escort you." The general stood staring, trying to figure me out. His 4 stars glinted in the sun. He and Cotton were at polar ends of the military pay scale. "Sir," I said, "the tour is part of the requirements for earning that pin, and I have the utmost confidence in Fireman Cotton. He knows the ship as well as I do." Zinni was stunned that I would give up my face time and let an enlisted man escort a 4-star. That this poised 20-year-old neither choked nor forgot his lines, and that his knowledge of the ship was quite sophisticated, shocked the general, but pleased him enormously. It was a grand slam. That evening, General Zinni was scheduled to speak about leadership at the Navy's birthday ball. As he was driving to the ball, Tom Fargo later told me he ripped up his speech and made notes for another. The new talk focused on leadership on USS Benfold, specifically how we empowered our young sailors to assume major responsibilities, including giving calm, expert tours of the ship to VIPs so high on the food chain that officers on other ships would probably stutter in their presence. Zinni's listeners got the message. That was Benfold's day to shine, the day we started earning our reputation as the go-to ship in the Persian Gulf. After the Cotton-Zinni tour, the crew saw how serious I was about the ESWAS program, and their zeal redoubled. We soon qualified almost 200 of our 310 sailors, all of whom took great pride in wearing the pin. In turn, I could be proud of sailors who understood how the entire ship operated, exponentially increasing our combat readiness. There is no downside to having employees who know how every division of an organization functions. The challenge is finding incentives to motivate them to want to do so. In our case, it was easy. 200 sailors were not only proud to wear their ESWAS pins, they got liberty they otherwise would be denied. Chapter 10. Build up your people. Leadership, as I have said, is mostly the art of doing simple things very well. However, we sometimes make it far tougher than it needs to be. Unlike some leaders, I prefer to build myself up by strengthening others in helping them feel good about their jobs and themselves. When that happens, their work improves, and my own morale leaps. I left drill sergeant bullying to other leaders with other goals. Running Benfold demanded brains and initiative, not brawn. Only competent and self-confident sailors could handle the ship's complexities and fulfill its missions. These sailors could not be sculpted into a fighting crew by ruling with fear and punishing them as though they were inept kids. My job was to turn kids into grown-ups who would make Edward Benfold proud. I focused on building self-esteem. I know that most of us carry around an invisible backpack full of childhood insecurities, and that many sailors often struggled under the load of past insults, including being scorned at home or squashed at school. I could make the load either heavier or lighter, and the right choice was obvious. Instead of tearing people down to make them into robots, I tried to show them that I trusted and believed in them. Show me a manager who ignores the power of praise, and I will show you a lousy manager. Praise is infinitely more productive than punishment. Could anything be clearer? But how many managers give this fact more than lip service? How many really live it? Not enough. The same principle applies when you're dealing with bosses. Never tear them down. Help them grow strong. If you want to achieve anything in a large bureaucracy, get inside the boss's heads. Anticipate what they want before they know they want it. Take on their problems. Make them look so good that you become indispensable. When they can't get along without you, they will support nearly anything you seek to accomplish. Little things make big successes. Within a couple of months of my taking over, other ship commanders began visiting Benfold to find out how we were getting our sailors to work so well. I was delighted to share all our secrets. They were hardly profound. Mainly, we were attentive to people's feelings and potential. A lot of seemingly small gestures added up to a friendly and supportive atmosphere. For example, I ordered a big supply of greeting cards that read, "The officers and crew of the USS Benfold wish you a happy birthday." Each month, my ship's office gave me a birthday list of my sailor spouses. I would write, say, "Dear Marie" at the top and sign it, "Love, Mike." Every card included my PS saying, "Your husband or wife is doing a great job," even if he or she were not. I knew the cards worked because sailors often came by to express their appreciation. It was my way of bringing their families into our orbit. The CEO of one of our sister ships loved the idea and immediately ordered his executive officer to send out birthday cards to the spouses of all his sailors. Of course, he meant they should be sent out at the appropriate time, on the spouses' birthdays. The next day, a year's worth of cards went out on the same day in one huge batch. Ouch. But in fact, this was symptomatic of that ship. The officers were good, but they sometimes didn't get things quite right. They weren't Benfold's officers. I think they hit a performance ceiling because they didn't create a supportive climate that encouraged sailors to reach beyond their own expectations. Ultimately, that was Benfold's edge. I observed that most of my young sailors came from hardscrabble backgrounds and had struggled to make it into the Navy. I put myself in their parents' shoes and imagined how they would feel if they got a letter from their kid's commanding officer, and I imagined how the kids would feel when their parents told them. I began writing letters to the parents, especially when their sons or daughters did something I could honestly praise. When the letters arrived, the parents invariably called their children to say how proud they were of them. To this day, I get Christmas cards from grateful parents. One young man who wasn't star material was working on a project with four outstanding sailors. I debated whether he deserved one of my letters. Because he was part of a stellar group, I went ahead. His parents were divorced, so I sent a letter to each parent. About 2 weeks later, the sailor knocked on my door with tears streaming down his face. "What's wrong?" I asked. "I just got a call from my father, who all my life told me I'm a failure. This time he said he'd just read your letter, and he wanted to congratulate me and say how proud he was of me. It's the first time in my entire life he's actually encouraged me. Captain, I can't thank you enough." My own tear ducts held, but I was very moved. One of my true star sailors was a second-class petty officer, Darren Barton, of Little Rock, Arkansas. Darren was one of the sailors who did an outstanding job with the Tomahawk cruise missiles. I wrote his mother, Carol, about how well her son had performed. She was so proud that one day when President Clinton was visiting Little Rock, she staked out his motorcade and asked him to countersign my letter. She sent me a copy of that letter signed by the President of the United States, and I was extremely happy to share in her pride of her son. My officers knew that they could always use me in their leadership toolkits. They never hesitated to knock on my door and say, "Hey, Captain, next time you're out walking around the ship, Sonerman Smith really aced that data bank." Or, "Seaman Jones is doing a hell of a job in the laundry. Could you stop by and tell him how much you appreciate him?" Those conversations were the highlight of my day, and they didn't cost me or the Navy a dime. The more I went around meeting sailors, the more they talked to me openly and intelligently. The more I thanked them for their hard work, the harder they worked. The payoff in morale was palpable. I'm absolutely convinced that positive personal reinforcement is the essence of effective leadership. Yet, some leaders seem to be moving away from it. They stay connected electronically with email and cell phones, but they're disconnected personally, and many leaders almost never leave their offices. People seem to think that if you send somebody a compliment online, it's as good as the human touch. It is not. It's easier, but much less effective. Social interaction is getting lost in a digital world that trades more in abstractions than in face-to-face relations. It's more than a shame. It's a bottom-line mistake. As I have said before, my sister Connie works for a major bank. One of her people did a phenomenal job making hundreds of thousands of dollars for the bank, and Connie's boss sent an email congratulating and thanking her. That very afternoon, he rode the elevator with her and didn't even acknowledge her existence. It completely wiped out any good his email could have done. Recall how you feel when your own boss tells you, "Good job." Do your people and yourself a favor. Say it in person if you can. Press the flesh. Open yourself. Coldness congeals. Warmth heals. Little things make big successes. The Navy has a program that assigns an ombudsman for every ship as a contact point for sailors' families. The idea is to make it as easy as possible to keep families informed of new orders, events aboard ship, the ship's movements in general, and of course to have a communications link between sailors and their families. In practice, the ombudsman is usually the spouse of someone on the ship and is the hub for all the other families wanting to keep in touch with their relatives on board. We set out to make Benfold's ombudsman program the best in the Navy, and in fact, our ombudsman was phenomenal. Sylvia Skanky had a special phone line for families to call and leave messages for her, which she responded to by calling the ship or sending an email. She kept everyone informed about the ship's changing schedule. If there was an accident on board, we told her immediately what was happening, and she passed the word to the families of anyone involved. If there was a death in a sailor's family, the ombudsman would make the arrangements to fly him or her back to the States. If a relative was hospitalized, she passed information back and forth. She even helped families who were having trouble coping with the stress of separation. She was a great resource and another way of keeping the crew strong and united. The less they have to worry about home, the more time and attention they have for the ship. Most businesses should have a similar program, but hardly any do. For instance, I know of a manager who had a heart attack while on the road, but the company had no procedure in place to fly his family out to be with him in the hospital, and in general, to ease a time of trauma. Personnel departments aren't usually organized to do that. In fact, many of the techniques that we developed in the Navy could be easily adapted for personal reinforcement in the civilian workplace. For example, the Navy hands out medals for superior performance, but not when a sailor leaves the service. Leaving is perceived as breaking ranks and mildly inconsiderate of those left behind. I disagreed with that policy, believing that medals send two important signals even when they are given to departing people. They tell those leaving that their services have been valued, equally important, they show those remaining that their hard work will be recognized in the same way when they leave. The commanding officer of a ship is authorized to hand out 15 medals a year. I wanted to err on the side of excess, so in my first year I passed out 115. Nearly every time a sailor left, I gave him or her a medal. Even if they hadn't been star players, they got medals in a public ceremony as long as they had done their best every day. I delivered a short speech describing how much we cherished the recipient's friendship, camaraderie, and hard work. It wasn't unusual for people to cry at those ceremonies. Sometimes the departing sailor's shipmates told funny stories, recalling his or her foibles, trials, and triumphs. The award I handed out was called the Navy Achievement Medal. I often think that every company should have an equivalent. The General Electric Quality Star, say, or the IBM Order of Excellence, or the Microsoft Medal of Distinction. There is absolutely no downside to this symbolic gesture, provided it is done sincerely and without hype. Trust people. They usually prove you're right. Once a year, all Navy ships undergo a thorough assessment in which outside inspectors validate the ship's readiness. The ship as a whole and the crew's abilities and proficiencies are rated in 24 categories on a scale ranging from basic level 1 to advanced level 4. The purpose is to determine how much additional training the crew needs to be ready for combat. But if you assume that the higher a ship's level, the less time it would spend training at sea, you would be wrong. In fact, regardless of its readiness rating, every ship spends the next 6 months training at sea. Thus, there was no incentive to reach level 4, and in fact, no ship ever did. Level 1 was the required minimum, and that was usually considered good enough. Then, Benfold came along. Originally, my goal was to reach an overall rating of level 2. But when I recognized the enormous potential of my crew, I raised the bar to level 3, much to the chagrin of those who saw it as a quantum leap in their labor and my hubris. I must also admit that in addition to my noble motive of making the ship as good as it could be, I wanted to blow my arch rival out of the water. Their assessment was scheduled to begin the week following ours. My rival's strategy was to do little and attain basic level 1. The CO had no idea that we were laying the groundwork to shake things up a little. In fact, we were about to rock his world. Our first challenge was finding enough senior people to supervise the 24 areas of testing. My combat systems officer hit me with the unexpected news that we only had 20 qualified people who were not involved in other critical operations. Thinking fast, I said, "Fine, pick supervisors from the next group down. You don't always need a senior person in charge. It could be a young third-class petty officer." "That's never been done before," he said. "See what they can do," I said. "The alternative is to do nothing, right? Let's assign senior people to the most demanding areas and work our way down to the junior ones. If we don't get level 3 in some categories, so what? We will get level 1 or 2. We have nothing to lose." As it turned out, the third and second class petty officers were so honored to be chosen that they worked hard enough for several of their teams to outshine those supervised by senior people. The search and seizure team was particularly impressive. We assigned it to one of the ship's most junior sailors because we suspected he had the ability to honcho it. The outside inspectors protested, saying they could not validate the work of an important team that wasn't headed by a commissioned officer. But I insisted, and the young sailor did such a fantastic job, that the inspectors ate their words and placed us at level 4 in that category. Breaking out of our stratified systems to trust the people who work for us, especially those at or near the low end of the hierarchy, was a useful progressive change. It let us unleash people with talent and let them rise to levels that no one had expected, simply by challenging them. Make Benfold the readiest ship afloat. In that context, how could we not have done well? The huzzas for our incredible performance were just rolling in as another ship was starting the assessment process. Its skipper, sensing disaster, exhorted his people to forget about level 1 and shoot for level 4. But you can't order an outstanding performance. You have to plan, enable, nurture, and focus on it. Indeed, that ship finished at level 1. 4 months later, the Navy's top boss, the Chief of Naval Operations, streamlined the assessment process and settled on a formal program that allowed ships to skip the 6-month training process if they could achieve the same performance levels that Benfold had managed. This model is now standard throughout the Navy, and it came about because we delegated responsibility to people who were ready and able to accept it. Newbies are important. Treat them well. One of the things the Navy was absolutely miserable at, as are many companies, was welcoming new employees. Recruits were sent to the Navy boot camp at Great Lakes, Illinois, just outside Chicago. They graduated on a Friday morning, boarded a plane in the afternoon, and landed in San Diego that night. And somehow, they found their way to the ship, to be greeted by no one. Worse still, no one even knew they were coming. After enduring boot camp, their first encounter with the actual Navy was to walk in on a bunch of sailors who were getting ready for weekend leave and would have no time for them. I started talking with new arrivals, asking them about their first day. They said they felt totally intimidated, that they had no friends and knew no one. They were lost for the first 48 hours, on their own aboard ship while nearly everyone else was on leave. I was 17 when I first entered the Naval Academy, and I remember how scared I was. If that was frightening for me, I can imagine what arriving in San Diego must have been like for these young men and women. I called my XO, Lieutenant Commander Harley, into my cabin. "What's our welcome aboard program?" I asked. "I don't have a clue," he answered. "Well, go find out and report back to me." The next day he was back in my cabin. "Captain, the news is pretty embarrassing. We do nothing to prepare for their arrival." "You have a 5-year-old daughter," I told him. 12 years from now, she may join the Navy. How would you want her to be treated on that first day?" "I'd want her treated very well," he said. "Every sailor who reports to us is someone's son or daughter. We owe it to them to treat their kids well. It is our duty." "What's the first thing you'd want her to do if she was 17 and just showing up on the ship?" "I'd want her to call home and tell me she'd arrived safely." "Bingo. Why not bring them up to my cabin and they can call their parents or boyfriends or girlfriends and tell them that they have arrived and are okay?" With the government's telephone rates, a 30-minute call will cost Uncle Sam only 90 cents. It will be the best 90 cents the Department of Defense ever spent. We designed our welcome aboard program. We found out who we were getting from boot camp, what flights they would be on, and we met them at the airport to bring them to the ship. Since I didn't sleep on the ship when it was in port, the command duty officer met the new people on the quarterdeck, shook their hands, brought them to my cabin, and let them call home. Their beds were made, their names were on their lockers, and the best performers from their divisions assigned to be their running mates led them on a tour of the ship. The next morning, the running mates drove them all over the base, pointing out the gym, the pool, the theater, the commissary, the medical and dental facilities. They also got the hot skinny on base life, inside info that's very important to a 17-year-old just stepping out into the world, who and what to avoid, and why, or warnings about, say, places not to go after dark, because they could be attacked or robbed. The running mates acted as tour guides, showing them San Diego's SeaWorld and the Hotel Del Coronado. We wanted these young men and women to feel as though San Diego were their new home and we were their new family. For their first 5 workdays on the ship, they weren't allowed to stray from their running mates. And within the first 48 working hours, they came to see me for a get-to-know-each-other talk. I greeted each the same way. "Welcome. I appreciate having you on our ship." In addition to welcoming these new hires, the program was designed to infect the jaded vets with their enthusiasm. All too often, a gung-ho newcomer runs smack into a poison corporate culture that sucks the enthusiasm right out of her. I wanted the newcomers to remain so revved up that they would recharge the batteries of those who no longer felt that way. Think about the welcome aboard program in your company. Do newcomers arrive for the first day of work and find that no computer awaits them? Their pay and benefits are delayed by red tape. And the only employee available to answer their questions is second rate because the best people are too busy. If so, it isn't surprising that they become discontented with their jobs and disparage the organization. It's the end of their idealism. I wanted Ben Folds' environment to be exactly the opposite, and it was. Our new sailors appreciated our efforts, which paid tremendous dividends in the form of workforce enthusiasm and self-confidence. Once people heard about it, our running mate program was adopted by many other ships on the San Diego waterfront. The commander of our destroyer squadron even made a home movie about the welcome aboard process for other ships. Be the rising tide that lifts all boats. Since World War II, and possibly before, the Navy has issued foul weather jackets that are made of ugly blue duck cloth that keeps you neither dry nor warm. To my young sailors, they were a fashion statement not worth making. While browsing in a marine gear store, one sailor spotted a civilian version he loved. It was made of flashy blue Gore-Tex with reflective stripes and a built-in flotation device. Naturally, he told me about it immediately. The Navy jackets cost $150 apiece. These were $90 and superior in every way. They would actually keep you warm and dry, and they'd be safer than the standard issue because of the flotation device. And, as a bonus, USS Benfold could be stenciled on the back. Not your usual U.S. Department of Defense procurement. This was more value for less money. Great idea. Sign me up, I said. We used the ship's credit card to buy 310 jackets and passed them out to all hands. We had a very cool-looking crew. The next day, when another ship pulled into our pier, its sailors saw our sailors wearing the jackets. Half an hour later, that ship's command master chief strode over to say, "My captain has ordered you to stop wearing those jackets." "Really? Why?" I asked. "We almost had a mutiny over there. Our crew wants the same jackets." Had that ship's captain not been one of the most senior commanding officers in the Pacific Fleet, I would have laughed in the master chief's face. According to Navy protocol, the senior officer present is responsible for a pier's security. And he had decided that pier security was endangered because his sailors coveted my sailors' jackets. "Why not just buy the same jackets for your people?" I asked. "They'd steal them," he said. "Before we pull into port, we collect all our foul weather jackets and lock them up. Can't trust these people." What a difference between ships. We never worried about Benfold sailors stealing their jackets. They could wear them home if they wanted to. In fact, they were so proud of the new ones that they rarely took them off. I told this gentleman that I considered his captain's order illegal, and I refused to obey it. If he insisted, I said, I would be happy to go to the admiral's office and accept an immediate court-martial. If that was an overreaction, I considered it justified. In part, I was remembering an incident that occurred while I was working for Defense Secretary Perry. The four military services use their personnel budgets in very different ways. The Air Force stresses quality of life. Its people get beautiful housing, great bases, and excellent medical care. The Army and Marine Corps take nearly the opposite attitude. A very comfortable Air Force base could be next door to an Army base where soldiers are living in slums. But this was becoming embarrassing. So while I was in the Pentagon, the Army and Marine Corps asked Perry to take money out of the Air Force budget and give it to them so they could upgrade their bases. He pondered their request for a few moments, then refused, telling them that the goal shouldn't be to reduce the standards for some, but to raise everyone else to the highest possible level. This had struck me as universal wisdom. Now, rather than buy his crew new jackets, this ship's captain wanted mine to stop wearing them, and I wasn't going to let it happen. He could have tried to have me fired, but that was a chance I was willing to take. That command master chief delivered my message and returned half an hour later with a new directive. "My CO has decided you can wear your jackets after all." That ship could have bought those jackets, but never did. Meanwhile, the so-called Benfold jacket became the rage, and my squadron commander ordered them for the five other ships under his command. Jealousy and envy are powerful emotions and, if acted upon, can cause serious problems. Leaders must always watch out for them. A jealous commander may behave in ways that inhibit and soon paralyze his or her subordinates, who eventually turn off and tune out. The antidote lies in trying to make the people who work for you feel needed and highly valued. Help them believe in that wonderful old truism, "A rising tide lifts all boats." With perhaps a few exceptions, every organization's success is a collective achievement. Build up your bosses. I could not have succeeded by acting as a self-promoting careerist. Nothing alienates a boss faster than people who suck up, thirst for his or her job, or both. My mindset was quite different. I aimed to be the consummate team player, a loyal servant to harassed bosses, whose needs I would anticipate before they even realized they had them. In the language of business, I would be a master of customer service. What my admiral and commodore needed most, I decided, was a self-reliant ship commander who accomplished whatever needed to be done without being micromanaged. They wanted me, or any other skipper under their command, to supply a whole series of fleet-wide bests. We would be the best engineered ship, the best Tomahawk weapon provider, have the best search and seizure team, and the best retention rate for skilled sailors, and we would come in under budget. It seemed crucial that I step up to the plate and swing for these things without being prompted or pressured. I rarely asked permission. I just acted on the theory that my bosses had authorized me to do so in their behalf. They wanted me to take care of things without being nagged. They had far too many other crises and problems. If I got my unit operating independently and delivering outstanding results, they could concentrate on other issues and do their jobs better. And that's what any boss wants, as well as bragging rights. My immediate boss, the Commodore, was just the beginning of what turned out to be a growth market for our services. The Persian Gulf situation offered numerous opportunities because the crisis with Saddam brought me more customers. That is, more bosses. Two more Commodores and a senior captain, who in turn reported to no fewer than three admirals. Despite being the most junior commanding officer in the entire Persian Gulf, I wanted to be part of the decision-making apparatus. I needed to glean as much influence as possible so that I could shortstop stupid policies in their infancy. I established individual relationships with each boss. For example, Benfold got to the Gulf 3 weeks before Captain Bob Mahler arrived to run air defense for the entire area, and we made it our business to learn what his needs would be. I sent him an email introducing myself, telling him I was at his service, and suggesting issues he might think about. Keeping the correspondence private, I didn't send copies to the admirals or draw attention to myself. In this way, Mahler didn't feel threatened. He understood that I was interested only in improving the way we did business. While he and his cruiser were crossing the Indian Ocean, I sent him personal messages telling him what he could expect when he reached the Gulf. I did this to improve our processes, not to gain credit. I wanted him to look good, and most important, I wanted to be able to influence his decisions. Normally, air defense commanders make judgments with minimal input, but since I had nurtured our relationship, he trusted me and was interested in my opinions, and he took my advice. This model worked so well, he included the other COs in the process. As a result, the effectiveness of our air defense in the Gulf increased enormously. He looked good, and he was generous in sharing the credit with us. Had I acted intrusively, or as though I had a personal agenda, I would have been shut out. Instead, I got a seat at the table when my bosses made decisions. The same happened with Commodore Mike Duffy, who ran the search and seizure operation. He had extremely high expectations and shared his pain when let down. Still, he learned to love Benfold, because we had also preceded him to the Gulf, scouted the search and seizure picture, and very privately sent him useful ideas for improving the process. He was pretty tough and demanding. We presented honest information in a non-threatening way. If he ignored our recommendations, we didn't go around him. We stopped. The customer is always right. He grew to value our relationship. Duffy admired Benfold's computerized database that speeded up the process of merchant ship inspections, distributed copies throughout the fleet, and didn't contradict anyone who thought it was all his idea. That was fine with me. Credit wasn't my goal. I wanted to be known as a team player, focused on making the Navy better. Captain indispensable of the USS Go-To. We also made a lot of grateful friends among staff officers, the immediate aides of the admirals, commodores, and captains. Staff members in any organization have a tough job. They are under the gun to produce results, but usually have limited resources. By privately helping them, we made them look good to their bosses, a win-win deal that moved them to praise Benfold, which enhanced both its reputation and responsibilities. When we got to the Gulf, the Pentagon imposed strict new requirements for arming and firing Tomahawks. Basically, the brass wanted the process speeded up. Ships with fewer and simpler missions than Benfold had trouble meeting the new deadlines. Why were we much faster than everyone else? Because our sailors sat down together, read all the pertinent publications, learned how all the equipment worked, and then devised innovative ways to meet the requirements. We sent a 10-page message to the other ships explaining our methods, which became standard operating procedure in the Persian Gulf. In fact, the entire Navy soon adopted them. The United States and its allies profited from our work, but the biggest beneficiary was my boss, Vice Admiral Fargo. Had he been forced to tell the Pentagon that his ships could not meet the stringent new missile requirements, he would indeed have looked bad. Instead, his fleet aced the challenge, and that made him extremely appreciative. It was our habit to assume initiative and give our customers the best service imaginable. That is why the Navy's war plan for the Gulf assigned the most difficult missions to us. Expect the best from your crew. You will get it. In the fall of 1997, we were in the Persian Gulf. I was incredibly proud of my crew's growth and performance, and I had numerous measures to prove it. Still, the better I got to know them, the more convinced I became of their almost unlimited potential. How much brain power does the Navy, or any organization for that matter, waste because those in charge don't recognize the full potential hiding at the low end of the hierarchy? If we stopped pinning labels on people and stopped treating them as if they were stupid, they would perform better. Why not instead assume that everyone is inherently talented and then spur them to live up to those expectations? Too idealistic? On the contrary, that's exactly how Benfold became the best damn ship in the U.S. Navy. It is also the way leaders in every kind of organization can achieve new levels of success. By encouraging the people working for them to express themselves on both a personal and a professional level. Benfold is a warship whose bottom line is combat readiness. That the military is an organization that many young people join to escape from bad situations at home, such as drugs or gangs, may present a particular challenge to achieving our goal. Although these kids know that they don't want the lives they left behind, they don't yet know what they do want. Getting such people to contribute in a meaningful way requires prodigious training and discipline. It also requires leaders who understand and appreciate them as individuals. A captain willing to do that gains a whole ship full of willing allies in the never-ending pursuit of combat readiness. One of the fringe benefits of all my one-on-one interviewing was the insight it gave me into each sailor's life. Nothing was more useful and moving than learning why a kid had joined the Navy and whether he or she had dreams or was just drifting. Most of my sailors had never had this kind of attention. No one in authority, let alone a ship captain, had ever sat down with them, discussed their goals, and helped them devise a plan to reach them. I soon discovered a fascinating fact. About 50% of my young men and women signed up because their parents could not afford to send them to college. They wanted to take advantage of the GI Bill and save some money for living expenses when they got to school. When I asked them if they had done their preparatory work, 45 of them said they had never taken the Scholastic Aptitude Test, SAT. Why not? Because their guidance counselors, teachers, and parents had decided they would never make it to college. Struck by this, I directed my second-in-command to find an SAT administrator and fly him or her to the ship. As usual, he looked at me as if I had a hole in my head. But somehow he succeeded. And one Saturday afternoon, 30 miles south of Iraq, 45 of my sailors took the SATs. When the results came back, one of the women had a combined score of 1490, good enough to get into most Ivy League colleges. She certainly topped my score when I entered Annapolis, and I had taken the test twice. The response to our SAT session was so great that we took advantage of a Navy program that enabled sailors to take online college courses. They studied a lesson, took an exam, and wrote a paper that they sent back to the instructor. I soon had more than 100 sailors enrolled. Another 68 took math refresher courses, as well as the college prep English that their high schools had failed to give them. I was convinced that whether they stayed in the Navy or not, all this learning was bound to improve our little piece of society. To my surprise, it spurred my sailors to keep taking other tests, Navy advancement tests, and Benfold soon had a promotion rate 2.5 times the Navy average. By upgrading their skills, the crew accomplished all sorts of things. We challenged their minds, which made shipboard life more fun. They boosted their chances of getting good jobs in the civilian economy. And they clearly enriched the ship's skills pool, which in turn improved readiness. I know business is tough, and bosses don't have the time or resources to play guidance counselor to troubled or underprivileged employees. Every manager in every company has limits on what it can and will do. But please consider my experience carefully. A lot of it is organizational attitude and mindset. Anything you can do to understand your people, support them in tough times, and nurture their gifts will pay benefits to your bottom line. Build a strong, deep bench. When I took command of Benfold, I discovered that the usual policy was to have only one crew member able to perform each job. One job, one person. As a result, we were one deep in just about every critical position. In effect, I was held hostage by the key people on the ship. If they left for any reason, I would have to scramble to get the job done, and probably not done well. It was very disconcerting. I started training backups right away and kept at it for my entire 2 years aboard Benfold. Not everyone loved that side of me, but being loved wasn't my priority. The trip back to San Diego from the Persian Gulf took 6 weeks, and the crew set sail in R&R mode, as they had worked hard for the last 100 days. People understandably envisioned a leisurely cruise from port visit to port visit along the way. For the first 24 hours, I allowed this mood to prevail. We relaxed, had a cookout, and just hung out. Next day, we hit the training trail, using a new program designed to speed the learning process. We drilled every day. People grumbled. They felt it was their right to do nothing for the 6 week transit home. I announced that intense training was mandatory, period. I told them there was a choice. We could do it now or do it back in San Diego, when they would rather be at the beach with their families. And I chose now. We not only kept our skills honed, we started training the third, fourth, and fifth string. When one team became proficient, we put in the second. And when that team learned, in went the third. Soon I was 4 or 5 deep in just about every position on that ship. Cross-training became our mantra. By the time we reached San Diego, we had young sailors, barely out of boot camp, doing the jobs of first-class petty officers with several hash marks and doing them well. By grooming people to move up and accept more responsibility, cross-training raised morale. By teaching them what their shipmates did, it improved team skills and spirit. The result was a huge plus for the ship. Back in San Diego, we stood down for 30 days while the sailors took 15-day leaves, half the crew at a time. Then we headed out to sea for a 3-week training cruise monitored by a team of outside experts. Their job was to assess our readiness for the next deployment. Ships, it seems,